listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Milwaukee is still deciding how it wants to formalize how its police interact with ICE agents. We'll talk about protests at City Hall and how other communities around the country are looking at the same question. Now, one of the most tragic and shocking moments in the American civil rights movement happened in September of 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama. A KKK bomb attack at an African-American church killed four girls, Addie Mae Collins, age 14, Carol Denise McNair, age 11, Carol Robertson, age 14, and Cynthia Wesley, age 14. That bombing was the latest in a string of bomb attacks targeting African-Americans in the heavily segregated city. Our next guest was there in Birmingham at the time as a white pastor of an African-American Lutheran congregation. He served in that community and later in Milwaukee at Cross Lutheran. He's devoted his life and work to reaching across lines of race, of religion, of economic status, and of citizenship. Joseph W. Ellwanger is a retired Evangelical Lutheran Church in America pastor. He's the author of the book Strength for the Struggle. He joins us now from our studio in Milwaukee. Reverend Ellwanger, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's good to be here.
Throughout your work and throughout your book, you're motivated by a concept called accompaniment ministry. You don't talk about doing work for people, but with them and walking alongside them. Why has that been such a guiding principle for you?
Well, that's the very opposite of the segregationist system and even, you know, some of the more white moderates in the South who would say that they were friendly and were not prejudiced against African Americans, but in fact they were very paternalistic, and they were really looking down upon African Americans, even as they said that they had nothing in the way of a racist attitude. And so accompaniment ministry means that you walk alongside of people, accepting people as equals, as people who have something to give to you as surely as you have something to give to them. And so it's all the difference in the world. And, you know, white folks may not recognize the difference in terms of relationships with blacks and whites, but blacks are very quick to pick up whether a white person is being paternalistic and looking down rather than accompanying them as equals.
And another theme you come back to again and again is the importance of reaching across religious lines to other Christian denominations and to other faiths, even in your career when that got you into trouble.
Yes, that's true. I belonged at the time to a segment of the Lutheran Church in the United States that was very rigid in saying that, you know, we were not supposed to be worshiping with people of another denomination. And this just didn't ring true. And I had my knuckles wrapped a couple of times because I did participate across denominational lines. And strangely enough, ironically enough, it was in the service, funeral service for three of the four girls killed in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, where I was asked by the father of one of those four girls, who happened to be a member of my congregation. He asked me and his wife, who is a member of 16th Street Baptist Church, they asked me to participate in the funeral service, and I had my bishop, in effect, that was not his title, at the time, but in effect, he called me and asked me not to participate because that would be crossing denominational lines. And that was one of the points where I made it very clear to myself and to my bishop that I saw the gospel calling me to relate to anyone at any level and within the Christian church, certainly, to be willing to walk with them and to worship with them. So I did participate in that service for three of the four girls.
Talking to Reverend Joseph Ellwanger of Milwaukee, his book is called Strength for the Struggle, Insights from the Civil Rights Movement and Urban Ministry. Take us back to that day in 1963, September 15th. when KKK bombers blew up that Baptist church and murdered four girls. You were there in Birmingham, and as you were just saying, in the aftermath, talk about what you saw and heard and felt there.
Well, I remember that very vividly to this day. It's one of those events that you don't forget. I was teaching an adult Bible class at the congregation that I pastored, which was about 16 blocks away from the 16th Street Baptist Church. But in the middle of our Bible class, we heard a loud boom, and it was so loud that everybody stopped in the middle of whatever we were talking about, and we were silent and for about 5 or 6 seconds, and then one of the women in the class said, "I hope that was not what I think it may have been, another bombing in Birmingham." So, you know, as African Americans in Birmingham at the time, where some 35 bombings had taken place of homes, of movement leaders, and people that the KKK thought were moving too fast, were so common that that's what this woman thought of that morning when they heard the a blast. And sure enough, about 8-9 minutes later, a young man came running into the church and looking for Chris McNair, who was the member of our congregation and Sunday school superintendent and the father of one of the four girls who was killed. And so that's when we learned that it was the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. And it was an event that put the whole city of Birmingham on edge, you know, very tense. In the white community, it was a very large segment of the white community that saw the bombing as a kind of comeuppance to the black community for conducting the demonstrations that had gone on in the spring of 1963. This bombing was a retaliation against those demonstrations, because the KKK saw that, and many, many white moderates, Southerners, saw that those demonstrations as moving too fast, too far, even if the elimination of segregation was something good, which they didn't believe. But if even if it were, they said that this was not the way to do it, not the way to go about it. So this was the attitude of many whites in Birmingham at the time was, well, this was what they deserved, the black community deserved. Others recognized that, you know, bombing a church, any church on a Sunday morning, was really a horrible thing to do. And so their attitude, whites who would not go so far as to say that they deserved it, would have said, well, they didn't deserve it. It's a terrible event, but they should have expected it. You can't push the envelope as far as the demonstrations did in the spring of 63 in March and ask for the elimination of segregation and think you're going to not have any repercussions. In the black community, of course, it was basically a sense of, first of all, grief for the families with the four children. There was a lot of anger, obviously. But just a few people who really wanted to retaliate violence for violence. Basically, the black community was saying, this is a horrible deed, but let's not pull ourselves down to the level of the KKK. And so in the middle of all of that tension, to participate in that funeral service was an unforgettable experience where the church was packed and 2,000 or 3,000 in the street who couldn't get in for the funeral, and the moans and the cries during the service, Lord have mercy, and why, God, why? It was that kind of a tense moment in Birmingham.
Reverend Joseph Ellwanger of Milwaukee is with us. He's a retired pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, serving in Birmingham, Alabama in the civil rights era, and in Milwaukee at Cross Lutheran for over 3 decades. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Reverend Joseph Ellwanger about his career as a pastor in Birmingham, Alabama in the civil rights era, then in Milwaukee, serving mostly African-American congregations in both cities. Reverend Ellwanger, I was born in 1970, so 7 years after the bombing we were just talking about, 2 years after the death of Martin Luther King Jr. And I think the way I was taught about civil rights history is that it was history. Things were bad. The civil rights movement happened. We're basically good now. And I think that's a pretty common attitude. What would you say to people who hold that attitude?
Well, that is a mixed bag, to be sure. Certainly, we have made some progress. And in the South, you can go South today with a mixed, racially mixed group and go into a restaurant and be served. And that is totally different from the way it was in the 1960s. And, of course, it's very important to recognize that what brought that change about was the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that the demonstrations in Selma were all about. And once the African Americans in the South actually got the vote and could even run for office, things changed. Even white folks recognized that, and white elected leaders realized they had to get some of the black vote or they wouldn't be elected. So suddenly things did change, and we can be grateful for the dismantling of the de jure segregation, especially of public places in the South. But the reality is that there's been a lot of pushback since then, even in the North and throughout the country, pushback against, for instance, the Voting Rights Act, which made such a change in the South. And we have I believe that the voter ID laws and other practices in various states throughout the country are a pushback to make it difficult for people, and especially people of color, but it spills over and makes it difficult for others to vote as well, especially older people and students. That's a reminder to us that maybe the discrimination is not as overt today as it was in the 1960s. That's changed, but there's a lot of racism simmering underneath the surface that pops up constantly here and there, and especially in the recent elections and in some of the violence that the far right has used to try to push things back. So the justice challenge today is somewhat different, but it's very real.
In 1967, you moved north from Alabama to join us here in Wisconsin at Cross Lutheran in Milwaukee. What led you here?
People ask me that question. Believe me, when I left Birmingham, Alabama in 1967, there was a huge lump in my throat. I really loved the people, the congregation, and the challenge of the South, and I saw the changes beginning to take place, and I really had a tough time with the call to Cross Church. But in the Lutheran tradition, when a pastor is called by one congregation, the pastor has pretty much the decision to make. Is this God's call for me to leave this congregation now and go to this other, or do I stay? And so I was the one who had to really wrestle with this call. And the reason why I did finally decide to leave what was truly my love in Birmingham was the terms of the call that I got from Cross Church were that they wanted me to come to help them to reach out to the community, which when the congregation had been formed some 75 years before, it was all white and German and Jewish mainly. But now, 1967, African Americans had moved into the neighborhood to the point that the neighborhood was now 90% black. And the congregation said, we want you to come and help us reach into the community, and we will walk with you in doing that. And so I thought, well, in 1967, we want this country to change. We want an integrated society, not a segregated society. And if any institution ought to be leading the way, I said to Cross Church and to myself, it ought to be the church. And so I came to see whether indeed we could lead Cross Church to become a racially integrated church or congregation. They had just begun to accept a handful of African-American members. And so that was a good sign that they were serious about it. And so I came.
Talking to Reverend Joseph Ellwanger. His book is called Strength for the Struggle. One very concrete change. I love you. In a chapter of your book, you quote Psalms, sing to the Lord a new song. You had a very practical decision to make about whether there would be new songs sung at Cross Church.
I do remember the day that Gloria Wright came to me. She had been a member of Cross, then moved out to the suburbs. And when I came, they had just moved back into the community. And so she was thinking of coming back to the congregation. But she's asked me whether she could form a youth choir at Cross Church. And I thought, well, any pastor who would refuse an offer like that must have rocks in his head. So I said, oh, I'd be happy to have you form a youth choir. And she said, well, I have another question. And she said, can we sing any song that we want to sing? And I said, well, any song that's all about the gospel and is furthering that word of forgiveness and reconciliation and all that goes with the gospel would be fine. So the youth choir was formed, and of course, began singing a variety of songs. And the congregation said, well, why can't we sing them? And I said, why not? So we developed an urban hymnal supplement. And what would you believe that 2 weeks from, well, 1 week from this Saturday, the Cross Youth Choir will be celebrating its 50th anniversary. It became a choir that really made a difference in our congregation and the community and in the Lutheran Church. So that was a more awesome beginning than I realized at the moment. But we definitely changed songs, and some people could enjoy that, and some couldn't. So we lost a few members over that, but we won a whole lot more.
Throughout your book, you highlight people who've inspired you throughout your work. Who do you look at, Reverend Ellwanger, who inspires you today?
My, oh my, there are many, and you'll in my book, I raise up a lot of what most people would consider, quote, ordinary people. Because when you accompany people, it means that you really are open to their gifts. And so there are people who have enriched me beyond their own recognition and awareness. So I don't want to minimize or overlook those regular people who've had a real influence on me. And Gloria Wright, who came asking to form a youth choir, is a good example of someone who had the leadership skills and really did a great job and enriched me as we learned a lot of new songs. But if you look on a little higher level, certainly I would have to say that to this very day, Dr. King has an influence on me because he was an amazingly bold prophet is what I would have to call him. The country sort of looks at him as a great orator and someone who definitely led the way in some changes in the South. But he showed really showed the church, and this goes across denominational lines, showed the church and the faith community, which goes across faith lines, that any living of the religious life has to have a connection with working on the injustices of the society, or else it's not authentic. And so it was Dr. King that showed me and showed hundreds and thousands of pastors and lay people that the gospel is all about working on justice for the whole community, and not just for bringing people into the church.
Reverend Allanger, thank you so much for joining us. That's Reverend Joseph Allanger, retired Evangelical Lutheran Church in America pastor from Milwaukee. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, some Wisconsin employers and communities are having a hard time recruiting workers, and a lack of affordable housing is a prime culprit. Find out why tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Milwaukee Police and Fire Commission has planned and rescheduled several votes on policy for the city police department and how it works with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agents, or ICE. The group met last week at Milwaukee City Hall. There were protests by immigration activists. Isaiah Holmes was there. He's a reporter with the Wisconsin Examiner. He joins us now from our Milwaukee studio. Isaiah, thanks for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, who was protesting there and why?
Well, it was a lot of community members. Obviously, the organization Voices de la Frontera kind of hosted and spearheaded the entire event, as they had for the last couple of weeks up until that point. But it was dozens of community members of all ages and backgrounds, really. Some immigrant-born, many people just residents of Milwaukee.
And this issue of how local law enforcement agencies cooperate or don't with ICE has been going on a long time. Why has this issue been coming to a head in the police, Fire and Police Commission there and from protesters lately?
Part of it is Voices de la Frontera has been pushing the Fire and Police Commission to strengthen their standard operating procedure in regards to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That's called SPO 130. They've been trying to do that since June, and the vote keeps getting delayed and delayed for various reasons. And in that time, a family has had their father and husband arrested by ICE in front of their home Jose Alejandro de la Cruz Espinoza, who goes by Alex, or a nickname is Alex, and his wife Christine and his daughters have been going to the City Hall demonstrations and speaking and pleading for his return.
What do we know about Milwaukee police policy when it comes to how and when they cooperate with ICE agents?
Current police chief, Alfonso Morales, and actually, Ed Flynn, too, the former police chief, both said that they don't necessarily want to do things like stop people and ask for their immigration status or do things which could negatively impact community relations, and obviously local police depend on the community trusting them to call them and give them tips and report crimes and things like that. And this can be a struggle enough. And then when you add the added pressure from the federal government of enforcing or the duties of federal agents, then it adds a burden on the police department.
And as we wrap up, Isaiah, is there a new plan for when the Fire and Police Commission would vote on this policy?
Right now, it's up in the air. The Voices de la Frontera is pushing for it to happen within the next 2 weeks or in 2 weeks. But I've also heard that it could be as late as Thanksgiving weekend. And they're really trying, and by they, I mean Voices de la Frontera and members of the community, are really trying to have that not happen so that as many people can be involved as possible.
Isaiah, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
That's Isaiah Holmes, reporter with the Wisconsin Examiner. Now we want to broaden this topic out to the national scene of how ICE is working in other communities and jurisdictions around the country. Angela S. Garcia is a sociologist and assistant professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. She studies international law and society and urban sociology. She's the author of the book Legal Passing, Navigating Undocumented Life and Local Immigration Law. Angela, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, we just heard a little bit about what's going on in Milwaukee there when it comes to relationships between ICE and local law enforcement. Is this a question that communities around the country are wrestling with right now?
Absolutely. Communities across the United States have long wrestled with questions of immigration enforcement. So this isn't necessarily new, but it's rising to a head now. Given a lot of the movement around immigration in the Trump administration. And basically, cities alongside states are falling into kind of two large buckets. There's cities and states that try to do immigration enforcement, encourage it, embrace it, take it on. And then there's those that don't want anything to do with it, find that it interferes with their charge to be involved with community safety.
Are there communities in a sort of middle ground at all where they don't try to do primary enforcement, they don't check immigration status for everybody they interact with, but for, say, people convicted of felonies or charged with felonies, they might alert ICE on an immigration status? Is there a middle ground there anywhere?
Well, there's certainly communities that don't have a policy written on the books at all, but I would say oftentimes that not having a policy is actually taking a stance in some ways. There are federal level enforcement policies that are pushed on to states and localities, and where the rubber meets the road is how they respond to that charge. So, for example, the Secure Communities Program, which Trump reinstated, it had been ended by the Obama administration in 2014 and then taken back up in 2017 after the inauguration. That program matches fingerprints that are taken of anyone who's booked and sent to the FBI. It matches those fingerprints that the FBI receives to DHS databases that does immigration checks. What happens is if you're flagged as someone who's potentially undocumented, that information goes back to the agency that booked you, and DHS issues a detainer. Where states and localities have some space to decide is what to do with that detainer, because that detainer is a request. And there have been federal court decision saying that holding someone beyond their scheduled release date is actually unconstitutional. And so many jurisdictions do not support those requests. And it's my understanding that in Milwaukee, that's the case.
And you've written about this on a policy level. We have a federal immigration policy, which is a pretty powerful thing. But there are also state and local immigration policies, and they often come into conflict with each other. It can be a little confusing.
It can be very confusing. In fact, a colleague refers to our kind of current state of affairs and immigration in the United States as a multi-layered, multi-jurisdictional patchwork. Literally, your threat of being deported changes quite a lot if you cross county lines or city lines or state lines. And that can mean, you know, a distance of several miles can mean quite a different context that you face if you are an undocumented person. And that's some of the work that I do in my book is talk about how that plays out in people's everyday lives.
Right. And you write that while there's an impression that under the risk of a raid or the worry about running into police, people are working in the shadows. You say there are a lot of ways that people, undocumented immigrants in the U.S., deal with that and live their daily lives. What I know you wrote a whole book about this. We can't go into all of it, but give us some examples of that.
Well, sure. I mean, keeping it sort of close to the topic of police, in localities that have deep relationships with ICE that encourage police to do the work of immigration enforcement, immigrants are generally unwilling to interact with the police. And that's even around questions of violent crime, either experience it themselves or being witnesses to it. And that's really because any kind of interaction with the police in these kinds of communities means that there is a heightened threat of deportation. When we talk about non-crime moments in people's lives, you know, in the restrictive places that I study, places that have deep relationships with ICE and the police, people inevitably have to carry on with their daily lives. People have to get to work, have to get to the laundromat and the grocery store. And so the ways that they do that, that I document in my book, imply attempting to pass as someone who has a legal status. And that extends from the way that they try to walk through public space to the ways that they dress to a minimization of using any language other than English in public, a real kind of forced or coercive changing of oneself in public.
And how about in communities where there isn't strong cooperation with ICE, the cities, whether they call themselves sanctuary cities or kind of overlap in policies, what is life like there?
Well, there's much more of an ease in everyday life, a sense of stability, a sense of local membership and buy-in in the community. And when we think about interactions with police, I want to say that even in jurisdictions that have strong sanctuary ordinances on the books, there's no magic wand or silver bullet that can entirely resolve the fear, especially between low-income communities of color, generally, and then add people who are undocumented on top of that, that can resolve some of the street-level tensions that unfold in these communities on street corners between them and the police. But that said, When I speak with people that live in sanctuary jurisdictions who lack authorization status, they say they're generally willing to interact with the police and give examples where they have interacted with the police. Tension, or I should say fear of contacting the police in those kinds of places often comes from potential retaliation for reporting gang-related activity rather than fear of being deported.
We're talking to University of Chicago sociologist Angela Garcia about interactions between ICE and local governments and law enforcement. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should cities, should counties here in Wisconsin have formal agreements to cooperate with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement? What should that cooperation look like if so? Do you agree with mayors of cities like Chicago, Atlanta, San Francisco, who are taking more active approaches to not work with ICE? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about immigration and customs enforcement, or ICE, and how it works with local governments around the country. Angela Garcia stays with us, sociologist and assistant professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about how communities are impacted by ICE activity, how different law enforcement agencies work with ICE or not, and how it affects the lives of the people who live there? Call in at 800-642-1234, or if you have thoughts of how you want your own city or county or local government to work with ICE. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go to a caller now. Ben is with us in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. So I think that undocumented immigrants are vital parts of our community and our economy. Many people are fleeing economic devastation and violence. Much of it was caused by United States intervention in Latin America. I think that it's incumbent. I hope in La Crosse we would resist the actions of ICE. ICE is acting in ways that violate the most basic human rights, separating families, treating children like criminals. I think that it's appalling what's happening, and I hope that we do not cooperate with ICE. And in fact, I would call upon fellow citizens to do what we can to protect our undocumented sisters and brothers in our community.
Ben, thanks for the call. Angela, what are you seeing around the country when it comes to doing what Ben was just saying there, in a sense, resist ICE activities in local communities?
Well, there are certainly activists on the ground who are doing a lot of the work that the caller referenced. So in July, when the Trump administration threatened large-scale raids across big cities with sanctuary policy, cities like Chicago and L.A., San Francisco and Oakland, mayors came out in force saying that they would not involve their police in any kind of supporting role. In the city of Chicago, aldermen organized roving patrols of neighborhoods so that if any ICE officers or ICE vehicles were spotted, they could send out alerts to the entire community. And these were community-driven and local elected-driven efforts. In fact, the mayor of Oakland several months back got word that ICE was coming to do a raid in Oakland, and she spoke out about it publicly on social media, issuing a warning to the immigrant community that this was planned to happen in Oakland the following day. Got a lot of pushback from the federal immigration enforcement officials for doing that, but there's certainly ways that both local electeds and community members on the ground who are concerned can speak up and push back.
We asked our listeners about this on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A lot of people shared just a common theme that local law enforcement should cooperate with federal immigration agencies. They see it as the default position. Law enforcement is law enforcement. You should cooperate across jurisdictions. And that's a pretty common argument out there, Angela.
It's a common argument, I think, among some sections of the public. But I'll say that it's not a commonly held sentiment amongst police chiefs and sheriffs themselves. So a recent book published by the University of Chicago Press called Policing Immigrants interviewed more than 750 police chiefs and sheriffs all across the country. And in red states and blue states alike, a majority of these law enforcement officials expressed serious concerns about involving their officers in immigration enforcement and said that immigration enforcement should remain a federal responsibility, in part because effective policing requires trust between residents and police. And that's what my book also confirms. You know, we know that if unauthorized immigrants, we have an estimate of about 10 million people and their families. We know there's about 9 million people who live in mixed status or mixed legal status families. If they fear any interaction with the police can lead to their arrest and their deportation, they'll be less likely to report crimes, make statements, testify in court. And then people that commit crimes will be more likely to get away with and endanger others. I think the other point to make here is that research consistently shows that immigrants are far less likely than those born in the United States to commit crimes.
Talking to Angela Garcia from the University of Chicago, talking about local law enforcement and ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, where they work together, where they don't. Back to your calls now. Lisa is with us in Appleton. Lisa, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Lisa?
Well, I just want to share a little bit of my experience. I've been living in Appleton for almost 16 years, and I still live in the shadows because, unfortunately, immigration is taking so long. It's not something that you can do so easy. Just sharing my story, I have 5 kids, and I have one in Milwaukee University, and he started this year. And now it's really hard for me to think to go visit him because you are afraid to go and get caught by the police in the area.
Lisa, thank you for sharing your story. Angela, does that sound like a lot of the stories you heard in researching your book?
Yeah. Lisa, I'd also say thank you for calling to share. I'm really glad that you're listening today and contributing. I think that actually hearing from voices like yours are way more important than hearing from people like me. I did hear very similar stories to what Lisa has just shared, and I continue to hear these stories in research that I'm doing now in Chicago. In particular, you know, the thing that the caller just said about having a child who's just started university but being unable to visit her child who's in university. I'm working with a family right now who's got a child who was accepted with a scholarship to a university on the East Coast and struggled a lot in even trying to get him there for orientation and to get moved into the dorm because they lack immigration status. And she's right. It's not an easy thing to fix. In fact, for many people, there's literally no line to get into to fix an immigration status.
Lisa, thanks for that call. Angela, what would you like to see change, I don't know, at the federal level, at the local level, to, help people like Lisa not feel like they're in the shadows like that?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that localities can do. They can, even from symbolic things that serve to transmit a stance or an agenda or an orientation on the issue to the immigrant community, I think those kind of welcoming ordinances are important, and they can lead to more substantive changes that involve resource allocation or institutional change to support immigrant communities on the ground. All of this is possible, and there's good examples of cities that are moving in that direction. But the caveat here is that these changes are important, but they're insufficient because only Congress can do a comprehensive immigration reform that will provide an attainable legalization path forward to the many people in the United States who lack authorization status. And so while states and localities can do quite a lot to manage the conditions under which undocumented community members live, they're limited in what they can do to change anyone's immigration status.
Do you have high hopes that Congress could pass, anything related to immigration?
No, I don't.
We'll leave it there. Angela, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
That's Angela Garcia. She's a sociologist and professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. We talked with her today about ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and how it interacts with local governments, local law enforcement in different communities around the country. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll get the latest in the ongoing impeachment drive, all the latest twists and turns, and reactions from Republicans in the U.S. Senate. That's part of our weekly roundup of some of the latest news in national politics. A lot of schools in Wisconsin are facing declining enrollment, which is leading to funding problems and even talk about closing districts down entirely. We'll find out why in a new WIS Context report. We'll also take a tour of Derailed. That's a new WPR podcast on the rise and fall of high-speed rail plans in Wisconsin. That's from a couple of our reporters on our reporting team here at WPR. You can find that Derailed podcast over on the WPR.org website. All that and more. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, when women leave the workforce to become parents, many of them hope to come back. But it isn't always that easy. Kate talks to the author of the new book, Opting Back In, What Really Happens When Mothers Go Back to Work. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about how economists grew to have a lot of power in American society and government, and why our guest says in many cases they've steered us in the wrong direction. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.